Thank you again to everybody that's read, that's helped us open a meeting, and welcome those that have joined us since we first started. And we hope you're going to hear something that's going to encourage you to keep coming back. So, yeah, like I said, we are a speaker meeting, and it falls on me this evening to introduce our speaker. And I scarcely know where to begin, actually. I was thinking about this earlier on. It feels like I've known this individual all my life. I don't know why that is. I've actually lost track of how many years it is. It's not that long, actually. But he's become a valuable asset in my recovery. We've been on some interesting journeys together in our discussions about the program, and it's always revealing and it's always interesting. We have a interesting co-sponsorship relationship, which is quite interesting. I don't know anybody else that does it, but it's very successful and it works for us. I love this man to bits. He's celebrating a fairly major milestone in his recovery today, actually today, which is a blast. And he agreed it. It's very short notice to come and share his experience, strength, and hope with us tonight. So he's going to talk about his journey into and through Narcotics Anonymous for 40 or 45 minutes. So without any kind of further nonsense, Michael, please share with us. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Steve. Thank you all for being here tonight and celebrating our recovery. And thank you for that really wonderful announcement. I'm an addict named Michael. This is a double three birthday. And just today, the other day, Monday, I got a card from one of my sponsees who lives in Nottingham. And she told me not to, she wrote on the envelope, no fronts. So I didn't open it until today. And on the front of the card is happy birthday with a ska, with kind of a ska, special ska man on there. And she wrote this little thing that is so appropriate because sometimes I like to start my shares off with a piece of NA literature. And this particular piece comes from the How and Why, page 112, step 11. We see that regardless of the presence or absence of material success in our lives, we can be content. We can be happy, fulfilled with or without money, without or without a partner, with or without the approval of others. We begin to see that God's will, in quotes, for us is the ability to live with dignity, to love ourselves and others, to laugh, to find the great joy in the beauty in our surroundings. Our heartfelt longings are no longer beyond our reach. They are a fact, the very essence of our higher power's will for us. And once again, that's from step 11, the How and Why, page 112. And I really loved that because it was like one of those things that was like, ooh, what a revelation. And then it just kind of sat. And then the part that really, really hit me hard when I read this, we can be happy and fulfilled without money, with or without money or partner or the approval of others. The part that really hit me was the approval of others. And I think part of my journey in Narcotics Anonymous is learning that how I can approve of me. And because when I was growing up, I grew up in Sacramento, California, and I live in, and for the context, you guys know I live in Scotland, so. And if you don't know my story, I'll just kind of rush being born in Sacramento. And at the I was born in 62, Sacramento, California. I had five brothers and a sister, four brothers and a sister, excuse me. And basically, we lived kind of the idyllic life of any African American family living in the suburbs. It was just my mother was a teacher, my father was a carpenter, everything just kind of looked kind of wonderful at the outset. And then suddenly our whole lives were disrupted when my two older brothers died in an accident. And that turned everything in our family upside down from Jump Street. And everybody had their own way of coping with it. My father was, and ironically, he actually got sober years later, but I didn't know this at the time. But he became he both my parents became more of drinkers, and that was what they did. And I think my mother abused her medication a little bit more than she cared to. It in it of itself, that was their way of coping. And as my siblings tried to cope, they don't think they coped very well. None of us did, actually. We grew up having this ghost in the ghost in the elephant in the room. And that in itself made me very aware. I had a stammer when I was growing up. So I was immensely shy, immensely removed from other people. I did not know how to deal with life with this thing. Now, and anybody knows me, if you got me going, you can't shut me up. But the truth was that I didn't want to talk to anybody. I was just too shy. I think there's parts of me that, maybe I should look in more into this, that may have a certain amount of autism or something like that. But I'm not. But that's a totally different 12-step program. My way of escape was fantasy. I didn't have my first drink until I had my first drink when I was 7, but I didn't have my second one until I was 12. I've always been one of those people that wanted to assert his independence but didn't know what asserting independence was. And somewhere along the way, when I was 15 years old, I discovered A, I was gay. B, I discovered my boyfriend at the time had marijuana and I had a joint. And I really didn't know what to expect from that, except I really liked it. And for all intents and purposes, it made me completely disown my past completely. Maybe my stammer went, my confidence kind of built up for the moment. I believed in myself more. I think for the most part, I didn't. I felt. Calm down, Domino. I'm sharing. Anyway, my dog's in the room. If you heard that little purr, that was Domino. Yeah, that basically was my start of my using. I was 16 years old, and from 16 onwards, I ran away from home. And part of the reason why I was, and I use this as a major excuse. I use my gayness for the or homosexuality as an excuse. But the truth of the matter was, I was still trying to escape my feelings. I was still trying to suss out what I was, I still didn't like the elephant in the room. And throughout my adult life, throughout my using life, I should say, I'm still on the on by the way, I'm still on the bridge on the fact of being an adult, but that's another story. If you haven't grown up by 50, you don't have to. Anyway, my using kind of let after a while, it was like there was no drug of choice. There was absolutely no drug of choice. It was just, if you had it, I wanted it. My drug of choice became more yours, and didn't matter how I went about getting it. It wasn't important how I got it. It wasn't even important what it was, because I would take anything, and whatever effect it had on it, fine. I dropped out of high school. I got my GED years later when I got clean, but that's something else entirely different. I managed to muddle through, somehow made it through life without that at that time surviving on my own instincts, basically. Someone who considered I was feral and whatnot. And in the course of all this, I realized, course of all this, hey, I'm an adult. 19 years old and hadn't a clue. I didn't have a job. I didn't know how to take care of myself, but I was an adult. I basically took care of myself all these years. And so every so often, I would end up going back to mama's house. And after she kicked me out, I came back and I apologized. I promised I would never do it again. And sure enough, I broke that promise the minute I said it. I do it again. And at maybe 22, 23, I think I decided that I had more than my fair share of my family's discontent with me and walked out of their lives for a very long time. And I'm not talking about, I'm not talking about a few months, a few years. I mean, it literally was, I finally got in touch with my family after I got clean a decade later, I believe. I'm not quite sure. But anyway, yeah, so I basically last 2 years of my using was like a non-sober event. I mean, I had not, I was taking something to get me going every single day of the week. I don't even know how I paid for half of that shit. It wasn't, I was never, I never had money enough to pay for drugs. I just managed to get drugs, finagle my way to doing, scamming my way through it all. Just basically, yeah. I mean, I used to hear people at meetings talk about they spent thousands and hundreds of thousands and stole things out of stores and whatnot. That wasn't my, that's still, that wasn't my story. And I still, this very day, can't remember what, how, and how I got loaded for the last 2 years of my life. My using. And somewhere along, I guess somewhere along the way, got jobs, lost jobs. Basically, that whole rhetoric. I didn't have mama to go back to. I didn't really have a place to live. And at one point, everything I owned was kind of like in hefty luggage. And for those who don't know, hefty garbage bag luggage. Scattered all over Sacramento. I didn't really have a place. I didn't have a, I didn't have a sink to piss in, bucket to throw it out with. I just didn't have, I don't know how in the world, a world. I basically used as many people as I possibly could to keep alive, is basically what I did. And then along the way, somehow I got an apartment in Sacramento off of 25th and Capitol. And I don't, I was at that time did not know how I was going to afford it. I just knew I needed a place to kind of rest. And I got a place and met the landlord. She let me live in her place with, first month with just the $250 to move in, and that was it. That was February of 2000, 1988. By the time June came along, I had probably made my life incredibly. I probably have used up everything and everybody I could possibly use up. I was such a mess. I got a job somehow. I have no idea how I got a job at Target. I just did. And, which was really a stupid thing because it was great and bad simultaneously because I had, because I also, got paid every week, and that was not a good idea to pay an addict every week because it wound up being spent before the rent was paid, before the electricity paid, if it was paid at all. Anyway, and my best friend at the time, who I'm still friends with, and I was having this conversation with somebody earlier about this, how we have people in our lives that were there before we got clean, that stood there with us when we get clean. And this particular person was this girl I knew when she was 14 years old, and we've been friends for fucking 40 year, almost 40 years. I still can't believe that I've known this woman for as long as I did, and we still get along, and we still haven't killed each other. She was one of the few people that actually called me on my shit and told me you need to shit, you know, get your shit together. Anyway, I remember I just had a bad night. I was using half the night, half, I had to be to work the next morning. I was actually late to work that time. And I remember walking into, you know, after work, I was having a really bad day. And my friend Kenny was one of those people I used to use with. And he was, you know, he was a bigger mess than I was. And he was clean. And I just, at the time, I didn't know what that was. And he said to me, you know, we sat there and we chatted and I told him what was going on. And he told me in so many words, I don't know how to help. I don't know if I can help you or how to help you, but I know a place that could. And he took me to a Narcotics Anonymous meeting. And let me, to give you context, there was like 27 meetings in of Narcotics Anonymous at the time in the American River area. And most of them were in northern, the North Sacramento. And I lived in downtown Sacramento, and what ended up happening, and, you know, and there's very few downtown meetings. And to give you kind of scope, today there are over 150, there, at one point there were over 150 meetings going on, there are 150 meetings going on per week in the American River area. And the area got so big they had to split it up. But this was after I left Sacramento, years ago. My God. I said that July 4th is when I went to my first meeting. And by process of elimination, you could probably guess that I didn't stay clean at my from my first meeting. But I can tell you what happened my first meeting, because I can remember that like it was yesterday. I remember walking in there feeling really embarrassed. And noticing everyone's shoes. And that was the only thing I could identify to me. I had no idea why they were happy. They were happy to see me. And at that point, nobody was ever happy to see me. If they saw me coming in any context, they would duck. You know, my family would not answer the phone if they knew it was me. So, you know, it was like, they, if I knocked on the door, they didn't want to know I was there. But they were happy to see me, and I asked myself, why are you fucking, you know, I thought to myself, why are these people so happy and I'm so fucking miserable? Well, that was what, that was my introduction to Narcotics Anonymous. They made me feel warm and welcomed and whatnot, and I just didn't get it. I just didn't get it at that moment. And when I got loaded again, that was the 18th of June of 88, I knew at that moment when I got loaded that I needed to go someplace. And at the time, there was no, like I said before, there was very few Narcotics Anonymous meetings in Sacramento. But there was an 12-step, there was an AA meeting hall down the street from me. And one of the first lines I heard from that meeting was 90 meetings in 90 days. And because this particular group had three meetings a day on average and expanded to five meetings a day on certain days, I wound up going to at least 270. I was there morning, noon, and night if I could get away with it. I was just always there. I was the most annoying person in that meeting because I was constantly there. And I was constantly doing, you know, at the time I didn't realize I was doing service there, but that group, one thing about that particular group, it gave people a chance to do service. And I was a coffee maker, and that was my first service commitment. And in that meeting was a girl, a woman who brought me back to Narcotics Anonymous 18 months later. Her name, it doesn't matter who she was, but I'm not sure if she's still in the fellowship or not. But one of the things I knew, she was my best friend in that group. And she told me that she was also the chair of the American River Area Unity Day, and she wanted me to be on the committee as a merchandise chair. And I thought, wonderful, what does a merchandise chair do? And she just like smiled and just said, just follow my lead. And I did do that. And I went to those meetings all the time doing service. So my first foray back into Narcotics Anonymous at the time was doing service for NA, but still going to Hazard's 12-step program. And then the irony of all ironies was I was realizing I was doing service for one fellowship, but going to another meeting, I had to go to another NA meeting. I didn't know where one was except in the North SAC group. I'm just going to run you down to my first 3 years and then I'm going to talk about, kind of rush through the rest of it. That meeting, the man that introduced was at that meeting gave me the warmest bear hug I ever had in my life. And I felt like I was felt accepted. And that acceptance was the reason why I kept going back to that meeting, and that's why I kept going back to Narcotics Anonymous. And Joyce and I finally just kind of said, let's go to other NA meetings. And we had to because we were on this committee. And so we wound up going to all sorts of NA meetings. And in 1990 was the World Convention of Narcotics Anonymous in Portland, Oregon. And neither one of us have ever been to a Narcotics Anonymous convention. So we thought, let's go. Couldn't be that bad. I mean, we were doing the Unity Day and we wanted to get some speakers anyway. And we thought, let's go to this convention, see if we can wrestle up some speakers. And it was so overwhelming for me because I realized that there was a lot of people there, and I was so overwhelmed that I just didn't know what to do with myself. And Joyce just told me to breathe, and people just told me just kind of be a part of. And the main speaker meeting came up. And one of the things that I remember the speaker was this man who was completely one of the more controversial characters in Narcotics Anonymous at that time, and the Clean Time Countdown. And for me, that is one of the most spiritual experiences I've ever experienced, because I remember seeing people stand up with, I think the one person had something like, I think it was Mel who was also there, and he was the one with him and Bobby, and maybe even Vito was there, who knows. But these people had the most clean time anybody in the room had. There were, at that time, I think they were like 30 and 40 years clean, and it was just like the audience just went manic. And I could tell you something, it was that, and then we came up to 2 years clean, and I could stand up and remember feeling elated about that. And then I just got hooked to what the power of Narcotics Anonymous and the power of the fellowship. And at the time when I was doing my first step, I was actually, you know, I did kind of the mantra of kind of first step, second, and third, which I at the time didn't know I was doing it, but the powerless over these people, and to run away or scream at the top of my lungs would make my life unmanageable. And I came to believe that the power in that room was probably sufficient enough for me to sustain some clean time that day, and turn my will and life over the care of that power. And at that time, I didn't even realize I was doing that, to be honest with you. But looking back in hindsight, that's exactly what I was doing. And I made my way through the fellowship. I'd done service. By the way, I got a sponsor at that time, and you probably heard him share a few weeks ago. And at the time, I didn't know what I wanted. And I was looking for a sponsor in NA because I had another AA sponsor, but I needed an NA sponsor. And the person that, but this guy with 3 years, he was a little redneck guy. And I thought to myself, oh my God, And he was the chair of area or the or region chair or the regional service committee member. And during that, during we had a heady business meeting at the time, and he had this resilience of calm that I could not, and it was the thing I wanted so much in my life. I had no idea what calm was. I knew what chaos was, but and it was a chaotic meeting. He seemed to have calm amidst this storm. Whenever I hear that statement, serenity is not calm amidst the, it's not calm after the storm, it's or calm before the storm, it's calm amidst the storm. And he had that. And that in it of itself is what I wanted. And some days, and I'll be honest with you, some days I really truly struggle to find that calm. And some days, but when I need the calm, that person is right there in my head sometimes when I need that calm, because he knows, I know what it takes. I know what it takes to have that kind of calm when things are just not at as when everything's kind of at zenith. He also, when I had an opportunity to move to San Francisco, which is a totally different experience, and I had this realization in a few weeks ago after listening to a speaker, and wonderful, and it was a wonderful speaker, and I can't remember his name, but he was talking about all the shit that he had to go through in his first 20 years of recovery. I had an opportunity to move to San Francisco. And if anybody has a basic text on page, I think it's 96, second paragraph, which is one of my favorite passages from the basic text of Narcotics Anonymous, and I probably read that as a mantra to remind myself. And the end line of that, no matter how difficult life's tragedies are for us, we must, one thing stands clear, we must not use no matter what. And I took that with me as well. I moved to San Francisco. And sure enough, San Francisco became a real, there was Narcotics Anonymous there, but my God, did I act out. My God. Well, let me just start by saying I got in a relationship, and after 10 years of being with this person, we broke up, and it was not, and it was a really messy breakup. Part of it had to do with him, but a whole hell of a lot of it had to do with my bad behavior and all level of my way of not dealing with my serenity. Had it not been for the fact that I reached out for help when I didn't, when I needed to reach out, because that was one of the things. Always people asking me for help, but when it came time for me to ask for help, I didn't know where to turn or where to go to. So I asked this one person. I told this one person I needed help, and he needed a flatmate, and I moved in. And at the time, I didn't have a job. And then I got a job, and I helped support him throughout his recovery as well, even to his various relapses. And up until 2006, I think it was 2000. Sorry, I'm trying to do math in my head. I met this person who happened to be a Scottish man, which is who I'm married to at this present moment. And I, with his help and his encouragement, he made me. He told me go see him again if you really like him. And it's like okay, and he lent me the money to come to Scotland to go on my second date with him. And what luckily I found out that I fit here as well. Now, I'm going to take a step back here for a moment because I just realized I hadn't talked about step work and except for the first three steps. When I did my first four step, was the one thing I never looked at was my part in anything. It was always, I was always a perpetual victim. And one of the things I didn't realize was I've created some of the chaos that happened in my life. And so when I told this to the person I told it to at the time, they reminded me that all that chaos was partially due to your way of handling stuff. And I can contribute that the way I handle how my parents handled things and how about the death of my brothers, that elephant in the room, which keep cropping back. And how much of my character defects were based solely on, learned behavior. And how I practice that. And through working through the sixth and seventh steps and looking at, okay, for me, and I'm not saying this is the way anyone should do it, but this is the way I understand it to be. So if I'm wrong, I'll apologize. But luckily the program is designed for even the most biggest numbskull like myself to understand how this program works, the work the step. Your character defects has an equal and opposite character asset, and if you practice that asset, the defect doesn't go away, but the asset kind of stands out and makes the defect even less likely. So one of my strongest, and I didn't see it as a defect of character, but forgiveness was not one on the cards. And when I did my eighth and ninth step and made amends to my ex-partner, and I still have to kind of clear that one up. I didn't want to make amends to him because look what he did to me. But you know what? I played a gigantic role in that, and that was the part that I needed to look at. But this is hindsight, so I'm just so. So the thing I learned most was not to bring that into the current relationship I have. And some days it's a struggle, and sometimes it's a pain in the neck, and sometimes I just can't. And then I have to take a look at, you know what? Act with compassion. Act with a little bit of dignity. Sometimes shut the fuck up, Michael. I moved here in 2010. Which I didn't think I was going to last that long here. I thought the minute I would, as a 50th birthday present, my partner gave me a trip to San Francisco. I went back to San Francisco thinking, oh, I was going to go home again. And I didn't go home again. As a matter of fact, San Francisco changed exponentially. It wasn't even the same city I left. And surely enough, just for the kind of weird context, which really has nothing to do with my recovery or anything else, but when I landed there, it was a rainy day in San Francisco, which I kind of expected. But when and the day after I got there, the day after, and subsequently, I was there for 2 or 3 weeks, and for every day until I left, it was the sunniest, warmest day in all of November. And then the day I left, it was the rainiest day in San Francisco. So it just felt like there was something smiling on me to do what it took to. And as much as I missed the city, I really realized I found home here. When I got here, the first thing I did when I first came to Scotland was to go to a meeting. That was the established fact for me. Whenever you get to Narcotics Anonymous, go to a different city, go to a meeting immediately. And that's what I did. And I found some really good friends that are still my friends today in those meetings. I had a friend, and the funniest thing was, I don't know how I was hunted down, but there was this guy named Keith who is no longer with us, but he celebrated. He died recently, but had 40 years when he died. He hunted me down to join a group called Decades Clean. And one of the things was, oh, okay, well, this sounds interesting. Because I was like, there were very few people in San Francisco with 20 or 30. I mean, there were a lot of people with 20 years in San Francisco. I was one of the people he headhunted. I don't know how in the hell he caught up with me, but he did. And so, and Funniest thing was that's where I met my current sponsor and sponsee, because I realized that, and that was years down the road, I realized that, oh, I made a connection online. And I had no idea that one of the first meetings I ever done on BlueJeans, by the way, was this particular meeting on a Friday night when it was the speaker meeting. But this is how I became, this was where I felt the most comfortable and at peace. And I could truly be myself. I hope I'm not making you dizzy with all the shit I'm talking about, but I'm going to step back to Sacramento back in the Christmas of 89 or 90. I can't remember when it was. I think it was 90, no, it was 91, because I had 3 years clean at the time. And I remember feeling really isolated and lonely and completely out of sorts. And thinking myself, I didn't belong in NA, and I didn't know what the feeling of loneliness kind of it was very pervasive. And this person I knew from this meeting I went to dropped me off at this place called the North Sac Group. By the way, I said earlier that there was almost all the meetings in north of it. I never heard of North Sac Group. I just thought they were having a marathon meeting, and I went to it. And I walked in and I saw a whole bunch of Harleys. I saw a whole bunch of people wearing biker leather. I saw a whole bunch of people in that meeting, and I was the darkest thing in there. I was probably the gayest thing in there. And the first thing they asked me when I walked through the door was, "Are you packing?" And I said, "No, I'm packing what?" And it's like, "Never mind, just go." I had no idea what they were talking about until I realized the guy at the door was actually collecting guns and weapons just in case something happens, you know, and they kept it in a locked box and gave him a little slip of paper to get their thing back. Anyway, I remember sitting at that meeting and being terrified, feeling like my very first meeting I ever went to with Narcotics Anonymous, because all these people, there was a sea of bikers there. And there was this guy, her name, which I affectionately call Spidey. He was a 6'7", skinny as a fucking rail, ex-con, who was speaking, and he had 3 years clean, and he told my story. At the time, I didn't think anybody could relate to me. I didn't think I could relate to anyone else, but this man told my story, and I thanked him for his story because I really related to him. And since then, subsequently, I've learned to listen. I think that's one of the things, the key thing is I learn to listen, and sometimes I don't hear a thing, but something will kind of click to me and it reminds me of all the of why I stay clean today. You know, 33 years is a lot. It sounds, you know, just went whizzed by me. I didn't even think about, you know, there were not times that I didn't feel like using. There were times I just like, I don't know how in the hell I'm going to get through this without using. I don't know how I'm going to get through this. I do know how. But you know what? There were people in my life that I reached out to, and they were reached back at me. When I told them I had a, and subsequently, people reached out to me, and I reached back to them. And hopefully, we kept each other clean that day. You know, and since I've been clean, I got married, I got divorced, I got my mother passed on, my father passed on, I got a job, lost a job, got another job, moved from Sacramento to San Francisco, moved from San Francisco to Edinburgh, Scotland, asked to speak at meetings, and the list goes on and on and on and on. And I never thought in my wildest dreams, no matter what was going on in my life, that I didn't think a breakup or loss of a job or my parents dying or the suffer or my or any of those things were gifts. I did not see them as gifts. I saw them as tragedies and consequences. But the truth is, they were gifts because they reminded me how strong I really, how this program made me a stronger person because of it. This program has given me the gift of asking for help, the aka humility. It gave me the gift of understanding when someone's going through something, that gift of sharing them that, you know what, of empathy. That gift, that wonderful brown wrap paper bag gift of hope, and something I didn't think I ever could have gotten. I didn't have hope when I walked in here. I didn't even know what hope was. I did not see it. You know, to me, hope was something that you can't, that's intangible. Until there were people in my life that I got, that got clean, that I watched get in here, that just did not know. And there's somebody in this room tonight that, you know, didn't know their head from a hole in the ground, even though I've never seen this person in person, but just hearing their story and how they, you know, and, you know, to see hope and change and gratitude in action is the most wonderful thing. And if I sat here and told you that I had gratitude and whatnot, it'd be a lie. But at the time, but nowadays I can hear it from certain people's voices. I can see hope from, you know, until I seen people who got clean after, when I first saw them, and I thought, you know what, they may be, you know, people didn't have hope for me, but today I have the hope for others. I have a sponsee who's going to be celebrating 9 years clean, and I remember when she couldn't get one day clean. I thought to myself, I drew the short straw with her. And she believed in me, and I had no idea what she believed in me about. But today, now, you know, it was because of the gift of you guys showing me how to live through life's little tragedies and life's great, great, great adventures. You know, life's rich pageant. I wouldn't be sitting here telling you guys the partial part of my story. I mean, I'm leaving a hell of a lot of stuff out because it's hard to eclipse a kind of put in context all that that this program has given me. The one thing this program has given me is the ability to. I do now know that for a fact. It's given me a sense of purpose. It's given me a reason to live. It's given me a reason to keep going, even when the shit hits the fan, even when things aren't going my way, even when things are going my way, even when things aren't the way I think it should be. It's given me the ability to continue on. And almost everybody in this group has given me something of some subsequential value that you can't, you know, you couldn't give it away for a nickel, and yet it has the most priceless thing in the world, and that's helped me stay clean just one more hour, one more day. And I'm very grateful for that. And I'm sorry, I just rambled on way too long, but thank you for letting me share my experience, strength, and hope, opinion, and what, for lack of a better word, wisdom with you guys of my recovery. And thank you once again, Steve, for asking me, and I'll leave it there.